Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of naturenow@kptz.org.
Hi, this is Nature Now for the first week in November, although if you look at stores, it looks like winter holidays. This is Mary Robson, and today, Dr. Julie Keister, the University of Washington, will acquaint us with her research projects in the Salish Sea. She is studying zooplankton and the effects of climate change on these organisms, so we will get to learn more about that and more when she speaks on Sunday at Fort Worden at 3 o'clock on the 10th. But first, our mystery sound. This is a familiar bird, and this is maybe one of the birds that almost everybody recognizes by its sound. And we are going to a few observations for today. Alex Henley will help with these.
The banded woolly bear caterpillar is traditionally considered to show by its color what winter weather will bring. It is light orange-brown with a dark black center stripe. The thought is that the wider the dark stripe, the worse the winter weather. This method of prediction is traditional, but sometimes ineffective. One source suggested that the stripe width relates to what the caterpillar has been eating.
The banded woolly bear is the larval form of Pyroctica isabella, the Isabella tiger moth. This caterpillar is now thumping along on the way to creating its overwintering cocoon. This will hatch in the spring into a tidy, tannish moth with black spots. If you see a woolly bear caterpillar that is solid black, it's not predicting dire weather. It's a different species. Spiderweb research. Some of you may recall my occasional mention of spiderwebs. I have three books just about the web and its types, but I refuse to call this an obsession, although it's approaching that. My books, however, do not relate the current research. There are many labs working on duplicating the remarkable characteristics of spiderwebs. Worldwide, spiders produce about six different kinds of web, each with separate attributes.
One study at MIT notes that spiderwebs can be 1,000 times thinner than a human hair. They have thousands of linked nanostrands to give it the tensile strength it needs. These studies certainly could not have been done without the equipment now available. This is information retrieved from the MIT Fibrous Materials Research Center. Most spiderwebs are essentially waterproof. One application of this could be bandages for your interior surgical sites, as well as eventual replacements for plastic. Research now concentrates on understanding and then possibly replicating these proteins.
Lichens. Just a reminder, winter is the best time to see lichens. And if you drive along South Discovery Road, the trees, many of them, have branches so covered with lichens they look flocked and gray. The lichens are not harming the branches. They just need a little light to grow their best. Get ready to splash into the Salish Sea and other water bodies with Dr. Julie Keister, who is an associate professor of biological oceanography at the University of Washington. Julie, I'm so glad to have you here. We are just going to jump into talking about what your work is, what you do, and I want to start with something that puzzles me, which is I know that there are different types of zooplankton, but how do you distinguish a little bit between them? Because this is one of the major areas of your work.
Oh, yeah, that's a good question. Well, to start with, let's talk about plankton just very generally first, which is plankton comes from the Greek word of planktos, which means to wander or drift. So plankton generally are all of the tiny organisms that float with the water that are too weak to swim against currents. And there are generally two broad types that most people will have heard of, I think. One is phytoplankton. Phytoplankton are like the little plants of the ocean that use sunlight to generate their energy.
They're making chlorophyll, basically.
Yes.
We just talked a little about phytoplankton, and the other one is?
Zooplankton.
Is that the one that is somewhat more animal-like?
Yes, exactly. The word zooplankton, zoo, like where the animals are, it means the little animals of the ocean. All zooplankton eat other things for their energy. They don't use sunlight themselves. They have to eat phytoplankton or other zooplankton or other detritus.
You began your work on something that for many of us, I have looked at these once under a not too good microscope and I was fascinated, but I don't know how you would get into studying these as extensively as you have done all the way up to and beyond your doctorate.
How does one get interested in microscopic life? So I came to them through a bit of a circuitous path. I started out studying fish. Uh-huh. And this was a long time ago. I was doing a master's degree at the Chesapeake Biological Lab in Maryland, studying the fish and how fish deal with oxygen problems that they have in Chesapeake Bay. One of the things that I was really interested in is predator-prey interactions, and the prey of these fish were zooplankton. Finished my master's degree looking at mostly fish, and then eventually, a few years later, got a job actually studying zooplankton specifically because I had a background, enough of a background studying zooplankton to get the job. And from there, I just became fascinated. Amazing little organisms. They're incredibly diverse, hundreds of species of them. They all do different things, look different under the microscope. They're just fascinating. So that's kind of how I got interested.
Well, and some of them under a microscope almost look mathematical. They're so perfectly formed. Well, I'm thinking, I think it's a rotifera. I'm not sure I remember that right. But it is a circular sort of critter, and there's a beauty to it. And I would say that's probably less important than how you work with them, but they are fascinating and they must be nutritious because a lot of creatures dine on them.
Yeah, phytoplankton are the very base of the food chain, even go back down further to bacteria, but most people think of phytoplankton as being the very base of the food chain and the zooplankton as being that second step in the ocean. From zooplankton, almost everything above them eats them at some point of their life. So most fish, for instance, when they're little larvae, feed exclusively on zooplankton. Some whales feed exclusively on zooplankton. A lot of seabirds do. So yes, they are really critical in marine food webs for that reason.
It must take a heck of a lot to keep a big whale going.
It does. And that's not my particular research, but I have read studies about the assemblage of krill necessary for a large whale to even bother slowing down to feed on it. It has
wow.
to be a huge, huge aggregation before they're willing to spend the energy to slow down it.
And the energy that it takes to raise a young whale, they have to have a lot of available nutrition from their mother, who then obviously has to even get more out of their krill. I mean, it's really an awesome, it's an awesome thing. I wondered if, because you mentioned working in Chesapeake Bay and about Chesapeake Bay, does the plankton world differ from one part of it to another? Is it different in Chesapeake Bay and in bays here, or?
So in one sense, no. And in another sense, yes. And the no part of it is that there's sort of a structure to the marine food web that is similar from phytoplankton to zooplankton to everything else. But especially the species diversity and total abundances of organisms is way higher here than in Chesapeake Bay. That's mostly because Chesapeake Bay is a pretty shallow region. I think the average depth is 20 meters. The average depth of Puget Sound is like 200 meters, and there's a lot more ocean influence in Puget Sound, which means a bigger diversity compared to an estuary.
You mean as in ocean flow coming in and out?
Yeah, oceans have higher diversity than estuaries in general.
Right.
Or maybe that's blanketly true everywhere. And therefore, the more that a particular region is like an ocean, the higher the species diversity is.
Is there anything you want to add about the nature nature of these plankton organisms other than their fascination and how much they serve larger creatures. You are studying communities affected by climate change and climate concerns. How is that affecting the extremely valuable plankton that almost everything in the ocean needs?
All of my research falls generally under the umbrella of how climate impacts zooplankton communities. What is really interesting to me about it is that because we have such an incredibly important piece of the food web that is incredibly diverse, lots of different species, lots of different behaviors, lots of different sensitivities, that studying them is like a very complicated puzzle. And what we're learning is that every species has a different set of sensitivities to things that are changing with climate, like temperatures and oxygen and food resources and circulation. And so what we're trying to do is study pieces of the puzzle and try to get an idea of how climate is in the going forward in the future going to be impacting our populations.
This then drives the projects that you choose.
Yes, I try to focus on what we think of as being the most important species in the food webs and what we hypothesize may be some of the biggest impacts on them.
Uh-huh.
And then we focus on those organisms and those processes, and we either design a field study where we look at how they are responding to particular stressors in the field, or maybe we do a laboratory experiment where we put them in bottles and manipulate their conditions and see how they respond over time.
And at one point, I'd also noticed that you use satellite data.
I do. And that's really fun and a very different portion of my research. Satellite data can provide a really broad overview of conditions like temperatures and chlorophyll biomass that from phytoplankton, that when I'm looking at climate impacts on a really large scale, then I can use those satellite data to help me understand the bigger environment and how that's changing.
For instance, 2 years ago, everybody was concerned about the change in water temperature through what they called the blob, which is not very specific, but this is one of the incidents that would certainly affect the creatures that you're studying.
Yes, absolutely. The blob was a huge climate phenomenon that elevated temperatures throughout the entire North Pacific and also, of course, Puget Sound in the Salish Sea. And the blob hit in about, late 2014 and through 2016-ish. And it really did elevate temperatures everywhere, which had a big impact on all of the biology, because fundamentally all of our metabolic processes are influenced by temperature. What we saw in the zooplankton is that they loved it. They seemed to really thrive during those warm conditions. They grew faster, and there were more of them, and that should have transferred up the food chain because there were more prey of things like salmon, prefer crab larvae and krill, and things that were really elevated during those blob years.
Climate change is not static. You can't say, well, it's got to this point and it's not going anywhere else. So one of the things that touches the projects you're in is it's constantly changing.
Yeah, and in unexpected ways. Nobody predicted the blob, and nobody predicted that the blob could have any positive effects, because everything we had assumed until then, based on previous events like El Niños, where it also gets warm, is that the blob, when it got that hot, would be bad for everything. And it ultimately was bad for a lot of the ecosystem. But and for zooplankton in particular, it seemed to be really good.
How about the phytoplankton in the same circumstances?
So we have more mixed data on the phytoplankton, and I'd say we're still trying to figure that out. There seemed to be more phytoplankton and earlier blooms of phytoplankton in the spring during those warm years, but it's not as clear.
Do you work with people providing you with data from a number of different sources, or are you focused on, say, you're working in the Salish Sea, then that's the extent of what you're studying? Or how does your project work over time and space?
Oh, actually, that's not that huge a question. I mostly work in the Salish Sea these days. Most of my data that comes from the field anyway is collected by a whole bunch of different people and groups and tribes and agencies. It's a big collaborative project.
That sounds as if it would be both satisfying and sometimes taking a good deal of organization to help it work.
Yeah. I have a woman who works in my lab who probably spends half of her time just organizing. it's not just organizing the sampling that the other groups are doing, but organizing the samples when they're delivered here and coordinating with them to get the data and coordinating with them to quality control the sampling protocols.
Mm-hmm.
Lots and lots of communications between all.
Well, and a good deal of your communication then involves in teaching people how what you need for your project.
Yeah, we've done a lot of work with each individual group that collects samples for us. We've provided them with thoroughly written protocols, and we go out in the field with them while they're being trained, and we make sure that they know how to follow everything really carefully so that we get really high-quality data. We follow up with them every year. We go out with them at the beginning of the sampling season and make sure that everything is in good order.
That is one of your full-time jobs, then.
Yes.
And one of the things that occurs to me also is the Salish Sea has some extremely deep places. I mean, we're talking about 600 feet or 800 feet or thereabouts. Does your sampling has to differ when you're dealing with a very deep area?
Well, some of our protocols do a little bit. We have one net that we call a vertical net, which literally you lower it vertically all the way through the water column and then pull it back up. And that's how you sample the zooplankton. That net is probably the simplest tool that we use, but one of the most informative because we've been using it for years and years and years. It's a time series. And they just put it deeper when they're deeper and shallower when they're shallower. Other than that, it's not too difficult to sample across different depth ranges.
But I was wondering if that, given changes in climate, if the depth affects the temperature so that somewhere in the depth you're looking at what might be climate change and other places in the depth you're looking at something that's fairly stable?
Well, that can be true that the deep waters change in temperature a lot more slowly than surface waters. We are kind of mixing the information a little bit by sampling through the entire water column. But it's also true that in Puget Sound, especially as compared to in the open ocean, it's so mixed. It's not mixed on hourly timescales, but it's mixed on timescales where large climate impacts are really affecting the whole water column. During the blob years, the whole water column was warmer than usual.
By warmer than usual, you're talking about, say, how many degrees centigrade or where? What is the...
A couple of degrees.
Uh-huh.
And it sounds like not much, but that actually is quite a bit when you're talking about marine organisms.
Do you have plans to continue the projects that you're currently working on? I mean, what's the lifespan of a project?
Projects and funding are sort of different things. The way that my lab is usually funded is on a something like 2 or 3 year cycle. The big project where I'm collaborating with groups all over Puget Sound is funded currently on a biennium, so every 2 years. But we hope we are going to be funded into the future for many years. We just don't know.
But that doesn't stop your work, but it does certainly make things complicated.
Well, if we lost funding for it, it would stop the work. That's a problem, needing funding to do the science. I would have other studies that are funded by other agencies. Any particular project has to have funding to continue.
What are you most interested in gathering that you can share with the people around the Salish Sea? What's your message?
Well, the big message is that zooplankton composition and abundances are really important to understand in the context of climate change if we want to also understand the marine food webs and fisheries and how many salmon are going to return and how the orcas are going to survive. And it's hard to understand the big questions without understanding the little organisms.
I was wondering because so much of what the scientific world needs and can do is to let people know what's going on. I mean, and I think when what you're dealing with is so vital, it goes all the way up the chain to the orcas. The struggle to somehow, quote, save the orcas is certainly related to what climate is doing for those microorganisms that you're dealing with.
Yeah, we think so. I mean, we know that the key is in the Chinook, and the Chinook feed on zooplankton in their juvenile phase. And we know that there have been long declines, which may be related to climate or maybe a combination of climate and anthropogenic influences from, say, toxins and diseases in the Puget Sound region. But yes, it's all connected.
I am fascinated by the range of what you need to be studying to figure out how the change in temperature or other climate influences affect these organisms. So I am going to put in a plug for your talk on Sunday, which is at 3:00 in the Fort Worden Chapel. Those of you who are listening and want to see these organisms and meet Julie in person, by all means, show up at 3:00 on Sunday, the 10th, at the Fort Worden Chapel. We very much appreciate your taking the attention and time to join us on Nature Now today. It's been really interesting.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you for your interest.
Until the 20th century, barred owls were residents of old, undisturbed forests in eastern North America. They were probably restricted from moving into northwestern boreal forests because of frequent forest fires. But fire suppression, along with tree planting in the Great Plains, allowed them to spread northward and westward during the past century, many along the Canadian border. They eventually expanded along the west coast, but they began competing with the spotted owls. Barred owls have displaced these slightly smaller and less aggressive owls and started hybridizing with them, further threatening the already compromised spotted owl population. Various methods of managing the threat, some lethal, are being considered in Washington state. Barred owls are forest birds. They tend to live in older forests, and they need large dead trees for nest sites. These requirements make them sensitive to expansion of logging. For this reason, the barred owl is often used as an indicator species for managing old forests.
I've noticed, however, that they are inhabiting third growth forests on the Quimper Peninsula. One appeared on my garage roof last spring, chortling out its presence, and it was quite distant from old growth timber. So I think these are very, very adaptable birds. Finally, some events. We've already noticed this, but we're going to say it again. The Port Townsend Marine Science Center, in their whole series, The Future of Oceans, on Sunday, November 10th at 3 p.m. in the Fort Worden Chapel. Dr. Julie Keister, who was our guest today, will be speaking on the future of oceans and particularly on plankton. The Dungeness River Audubon Center, which, by the way, now is going by the acronym DRAC. You have been used to them as OPAS, the Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society, but they seem to have turned into, happily, the Dungeness River Audubon Center. They have a bird class for beginning birders, November 12th, 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. Finally, the DRAC, the Dungeness River Audubon Center, has a lecture, The Ascent of Birds, also on November 12th, from 4 p.m. in the afternoon to 5:30. This is an invitation to study the spectacular diversity of birds. And what could be better? That's it, and thanks for joining us today on Nature Now on KPTZ 91.9. We enjoyed presenting this local and eclectic show. Appreciation to Alex Henley for both the voicing and the engineering today. Listen to Nature Now 3 times during the week if you want to, on Wednesday at noon, Thursday at 5 o'clock, and Saturday at 12:30 p.m. Podcasts posted on kptz.org come on after the week's shows. Thanks to all.